Our first case of the day is Ammons Lewis v. Metropolitan Water District, and it's appeal number 053123, and it's Ms. Bender.
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patricia Bender, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Dolores Ammons Lewis. This is a case involving a claim brought by the plaintiff appellant for sexual hostile work environment in violation of Title VII. I stand before the court today on behalf of the plaintiff, respectfully requesting a reversal of a judgment entered in favor of the employer. The plaintiff will rely on the arguments which were set forth more fully in her initial and reply briefs. However, in highlighting the arguments before the court today, I respectfully submit to the court that there were prejudicial errors occurring throughout the course of the trial. I respectfully request that the court review some of those errors under the doctrine of plain error.
Now, Ms. Bender, you're asking us to engage in plain error review as to a number of the issues that you've raised. But with the exception of jury district instructions, as to which Rule 51D2 expressly allows for plain error review, plain error review really does not exist in civil cases. We've said that we might recognize a plain error in extraordinary circumstances in order to avoid a miscarriage of justice in a civil case. But in what sense is this case an extraordinary case?
Your Honor, I submit that it's an extraordinary case because this is a situation where a sitting juror, who eventually became the foreman of the juror, because of a condition that he had fully disclosed prior to him being sitting, that being his anxiety condition, that he began to experience during the course of the presentation of plaintiff's case, the physical and mental manifestations of that anxiety condition. According to Mr. Bright, his note that he sent to the court specifically indicated that he was anxious, dizzy.
But you did not object to Juror Bright below. You didn't object in the district court, did you?
Well, Your Honor, there was no specific objection. That's correct. However, I would submit to the court that at the time that the note was spread of record, that plaintiff's trial counsel did attempt to somehow or another address that issue by requesting the court to admonish Mr. Bright that he should be patient and wait until all the evidence was presented. That is significant because, Your Honor, the most significant contents of the note was that Mr. Bright attributed the difficulties that he was having to the manner in which plaintiff's counsel was presenting her case.
But in what sense was there an objection to Juror Bright?
Your Honor, respectfully, I cannot say that there was an objection. So, as I said before, I believe that trial counsel was presented with a situation where she had just been put on notice that there was this juror who thought that the manner in which she presented her case was so irritating or caused this person such anxiety that he believed he was going to have to see his doctor or talk to his doctor. On the other hand, you had the circumstances where the court...
Were you the trial counsel?
No, I was not, Your Honor.
I didn't think so.
No. On the other hand, you had a situation where the court seemed to have been very much in favor...
Forgive me, Ms. Bender.
Yes.
I have before me the transcript of proceedings before the Honorable Matthew F. Kennelly, and it says, for the plaintiff, Ms. Patricia E. Bender. That is you, is it not?
No, Your Honor, you're probably looking at a motion, that a post-trial motion that I filed in regards to supplementing the record. I was not the trial counsel in this matter. The trial counsel was Ms. Jennifer Soule. I was not counsel of record. I did not come on this case until in the middle of the appeal, as a matter of fact. I was not even the original appellate counsel. So,
but
respectfully, Your Honor.
It says here is transcript of proceedings. So,
yes, Your Honor. I believe respectfully that what the court is looking at is, as I said before, a transcript of a proceeding.
Don't waste time on that. Thank you.
Your Honor, if the court has no more questions in regards to that area, may I move on to the second area? Yes. Your Honor, the second reason that the plaintiff is requesting a reversal of the jury verdict in favor of the employer is because there were evidentiary errors. It's undisputed that the employer did not disclose a photograph pursuant to Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The record is very clear that that photograph was disclosed to plaintiff right before defense counsel was attempting to introduce it during cross-examination of the plaintiff.
Now, why wouldn't that photograph have been relevant to the question of whether Ms. Ammons Lewis and Mr. Davis had some type of social acquaintance or relationship outside of the workplace?
Your Honor, I think it was not relevant because, as you can see, it had the effect of confusing the juror. As soon as that photograph was entered, that case went downhill, and then the case no longer became whether or not plaintiff's work environment was sexually hostile. The issue became whether or not plaintiff and Mr. Davis ever dated. It became more like a soap opera rather than it kind of marginalized the seriousness of a Title VII hostile work environment claim. So whether or not Ms. Ammons and Mr. Davis ever had a social relationship, that was totally irrelevant. And plus,
but wasn't it brought in because she testified that they had not?
My point, Your Honor, is that it was totally irrelevant. She did not testify that they had not had a social relationship. As a matter of fact, she did testify even before that line of questioning came about that Mr. Davis was familiar with all members of her family. As a matter of fact, they had attended various social gatherings or whatever together, but it was more or less like social as opposed to a romantic dating relationship. And
why did this photograph, why was it relevant then? What did it show that wasn't already obvious from other evidence?
Well, Your Honor, that is exactly my point on appeal. I don't believe it was relevant to anything. And plus, as you can see, the photograph basically...
Well, why wasn't it harmless? I guess that's my point.
Well, Your Honor, it would not have been harmless but for the fact of the tone and the purpose of which that was introduced. As I said before, you can tell the tone of the case then became whether or not there was a relationship between or even a prior relationship between Dolores Salmon Lewis and Willie Davis. The defense, in other words, they created a disputed issue on that matter, and in doing so, they created an issue as to whether or not these two parties had ever dated, which, as I indicated in the brief, was really irrelevant to the issue of whether or not the assault involved was sexual in nature. Your Honor, I see that my warning light is about to come on. If I may continue, please.
Or, surely. Okay. That's telling you that you're going into your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So my point is that in addition to the photograph and the testimony from the police officer, who, again, her identity, the full identity, was never disclosed until at the time that the court was reading off the list of witnesses to the veneery.
But trial counsel knew 6 months prior to trial that the district intended to call a K guy, and I gather there was a copy of the police report with Officer Guy's first initial, last name, and star number on it. And I do not understand how, trial counsel was caught by surprise.
Well, trial counsel believed, based upon the record, it's very clear that plaintiff had indicated that she had been interviewed by a male officer. So K could be Kevin, it could be Keith.
I know, but isn't it trial counsel's responsibility to find out if it's Kevin, Keith, or Keisha?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure puts the duty upon the proponent of that witness to disclose and fully disclose to opposing party the identity, the full identity of the witness. Yes, the trial counsel could have, but I believe the obligation, the violation, the error occurred as a result of defense not following Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and fully disclosing the identity of its witnesses. So my point, Your Honor, is that these two combined errors in violation of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure all allow the defense to bolster a created argument that a dating relationship between plaintiff and Willie Davis negated the fact that the incident that occurred on December 12, 2001 was sexual in nature. And
you might want to save a little time for your rebuttal.
Very well, yeah, very well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lee.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kevin Lee, and I represent the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago, the appellant in this matter. This is a case where there are two overriding themes that permeate this appeal. One is that this case was decided based upon the credibility of the plaintiff. And the second is that the issues that the plaintiff raises in this appellate court are, by and large, things that she failed to object to at the lower court level. Now, with regard to the errors which are alleged concerning the selection of the jurors, it's the appellant's position that plaintiff waived any opportunity to express these errors in this forum because she failed to make appropriate objections at the time at the district court level. And as the court intimated, I have serious doubts whether alleging plain error is the proper vehicle to now try to challenge the propriety of using these jurors at the lower court level. With respect to some of the points that were raised during the appellee's presentation, I'd like to touch briefly on those. Ms. Bender suggested that this was an extraordinary case and therefore it should be reversed and these issues should be considered on plain error. However, they have failed to present any evidence to show that this is such an extraordinary case that it should be reversed on plain error. Most of the issues that they raise are issues which are based on credibility, and the trier of fact was in the best position to determine credibility. She suggested that the admission of the photograph caused jury confusion. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that the jury was confused when that photograph was used for impeachment of the plaintiff.
You know, Mr. Lee, in the brief and again just now, your argument is that the photograph was allowed solely for impeachment purposes. But Ms. Ammons-Lewis's brief indicates in the reply, that the district court admitted the photograph as substantive evidence. Is she right?
Well, I would take issue with that. I would say that the photograph was issued for purposes of impeachment.
And it was both, wasn't it?
Well, in effect, what the court did was, after it was used for impeachment, the court allowed the document into evidence. However, the only issue for which that photograph was relevant was for impeachment of the plaintiff's contention that she never went to a social gathering with Mr. Davis. That's the issue that it was offered for, that limited purpose, and by the very nature of that exhibit, that's all that it addressed. So admitting that exhibit as for impeachment did not...
Weren't you trying to show that there was a romantic relationship between these people, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, and we submitted...
Well, didn't the photograph go to that attempt to show that?
Well, it could be argued that the photograph could be considered for that purpose, but what we offered it for at the time that it came up during the cross-examination of the plaintiff was to show that she was at a social gathering with Mr. Davis despite her testimony at trial that never occurred. Now, with Your Honor's point of whether or not this proves that there was some sort of a relationship between the plaintiff and Mr. Davis or whether or not that could go toward that, even if we assume that is the case, it would be our position that this photograph, which was admitted, would not damage the plaintiffs because there was ample evidence in the record that was submitted other than the photograph to demonstrate that there was a relationship between the two of them, and that evidence consisted of one of the plaintiff's own witnesses, Elnora Wilson, who testified that there was a dating relationship between them. One of plaintiff's co-workers, Charles Jones, also testified that there was a romantic relationship between the two. And, of course, Officer Keisha Guy, who was an independent witness who was not connected with either side, didn't know either side, said that when she filled out the report, the plaintiff said to her, this was an incident involving her ex-boyfriend. So even if we are to assume that the impression that could be taken from the photograph was that there was a romantic relationship between the two of them, it could only be considered harmless because there was the evidence in the record was replete that there was, in fact, a romantic relationship between the two of them. Now, it's an interesting point in the plaintiff's brief with regard to the photograph. The plaintiff argues that the photograph didn't show that this was a romantic relationship, but they also attempt to argue that the prejudice outweighs the probative value of the photograph, which I consider to be inconsistent. Either it's one or the other. Now, I started out by saying that this case turns largely on credibility, and there hasn't been any substantial recitation of the facts, and I'm sure that Your Honors have reviewed the facts of this case. But to the extent that a plaintiff is advancing the argument that the evidence was so overwhelmingly in her favor that the decision automatically should have been granted for the plaintiff, I think it's important to note that during the cross-examination of the plaintiff was impeached on several times. As a matter of fact, the plaintiff testified that she was not interviewed at all after this incident at the police department by a female police officer. She was impeached on that point. She was impeached on the question of whether or not she told her brothers to have Davis stop harassing her and coming to her house. She was impeached when she stated that she saw the magazines in the workplace for 4 years, from 1998 to 2002, instead of 2000, as she testified in her deposition. She was impeached on the question of whether her statement to Diane Gunn that the magazines would be a good case of sexual harassment was said by her. And this is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the plaintiff's credibility problems. So, as I said, the overwhelming theme of this case is that it was determined based on credibility, and this was an issue for the trier of fact that they would be in the best position to ascertain. Now, with respect to the testimony of Officer Keisha Guy, the plaintiff has raised the issue that they were unfairly prejudiced by the fact that Officer Guy was allowed to testify in the trial. They are suggesting that Officer Guy took them by surprise because they didn't know her full name. However, as the questioning from the court indicated, this was an individual who was equally available to both sides long before the trial took place. We had the situation in this trial of preparing the final pretrial order in November, and then the trial took place in June of the following year. So at the time the final pretrial order was prepared, we put a reference on our may call list to Officer Keisha Guy. We indicated the officer that took the report on the date of the incident. But more than that, there was a motion in limine by the plaintiffs to any suggestion of a romantic relationship between the two parties. And we responded to that motion in limine, which is in Appendix 6 to the plaintiff's initial brief, by indicating that we intended to call Officer K. Guy at trial to address the fact that the plaintiff had suggested that Mr. Davis was her ex-boyfriend. So the plaintiffs had 7 months from the time that they had this information to make any objections that they wanted to make to the testimony of Keisha Guy, and they failed to do so. They could have deposed her during this time period. They failed to do so. They could have went out and interviewed her. They failed to do so. There are a number of different things that they could have done and they failed to do, and now they bring it to the appellate court. As a matter of fact, once the case came to trial and the witness was called to the stand, there was also no objection to her testimony. They try to raise a argument that, well, Keisha Guy's testimony is of no consequence because she couldn't have been at the police station at that time. Well, if they truly believed that at the trial court level, after her testimony was over, they could have asked for a sidebar, moved to strike all of her testimony because it was not appropriate and because of this timing problem that they attempt to raise. However, I would submit to you, even though that timing issue hasn't been brought up before Your Honors this morning in front of this court, I would submit to you that that is merely a distinction in the plaintiff's version of how this happened. There's no corroboration of the plaintiff's assertion that the timing of the report and the trip to the hospital was, as she characterized it, as opposed to how Officer Guy characterized it. And keep in mind that Officer Guy, if you look at the record, she did not have a completely independent recollection of this incident, so she needed the benefit of her report. And that report was taken contemporaneously with these events, and she testified at that time that the plaintiff came to meet with her to report this incident at approximately 11 p.m. on December 13th and stayed there until approximately 2:40 a.m. on the following day. So the record, we believe, is very clear that there was no issue with regard to the propriety of Ms. Guy testifying, nor was there any prejudice to the plaintiffs. And had the plaintiffs truly believed they were prejudiced, it is inconceivable that they would not have raised some objection with the trial court. Ms. Bender also failed to touch on the third issue that she raised, which was that the jury instruction that was submitted was inappropriate and did not adequately instruct the jury on the law with regard to supervisory harassment and coworker harassment. I would just briefly state that it's our contention that the instruction that Judge Cannelli utilized was accurate. It did adequately state the law with regard to both.
Was there any complaint by the plaintiff before he gave the instruction?
Absolutely not.
Then why bother discussing it?
Okay. All right. Based upon all the evidence in the record, we would ask that this court affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Bender, you have 2 minutes.
May I please the court? A couple important points. I would submit that the court, in hearing the argument raised by the defendant, it's very clear that they relied a lot upon establishing that there was a romantic or past dating relationship between plaintiff and Mr. Willie Davis. I would submit to the court that based upon case law, and specifically the recitation of cases that were reviewed by Judge Shader, that is something that should never have been considered in regards to whether or not there was a sexual hostile work environment, period. Yet the defendant insisted upon that being part of your case. As I said before, defense counsel went through a recitation of facts that he said established beside testimony from the photograph in Keisha Guy that there was a romantic relationship. I submit to the court, why did he think that was so relevant?
You have a minute.
Okay, very well, Your Honor. And in regards to the issue of credibility of the plaintiff, yes, that's right, this was an overriding theme. The defendant misled the jury into believing that once they could believe that there was a romantic relationship between the plaintiff and Willie Davis, that they had a right to disregard the entire claim of sexual hostile work environment by the plaintiff. And it's very obvious that this is exactly what the jury did, because there was sufficient evidence of other areas of sexual hostile work environment, specifically the issue dealing with the creation and the perpetuation of the pornography. And as a matter of law, the defendant did not raise a defense to that. The record is clear that the EEO officer, in spite of having received a 7-page fax from the plaintiff concerning sexual harassment, did nothing. In spite of the fact that there was a hearing at the Illinois Department of Human Rights in which the issue was raised, she did nothing. Did nothing. The employer did nothing. So I would submit to the court that this is a case that, in the interest of justice should be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bender. Thank you, Mr. Lee. The case